You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Georgina Godwin, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes.
Martin Plaut, former BBC Africa editor, will join us in studio to discuss today's news agenda. What do you have for us today, Martin?
Well, how 5 million gun lobby members in the United States hold 300 million people to ransom, how Israel's courts are halting the detention of Africans, and Rwanda's Paul Kagame wins the election hands down. But what does it mean for peace in the Congo?
Also on the programme, Germany's days away from choosing its chancellor. Angela Merkel looks safe, but who on earth will her coalition partner be?
It may end up leaving the whole German system in stalemate, with the far left holding the balance of power and only a grand coalition between Christian Democrats and Social Democrats will be the answer.
Later on, we hear about a new campaign in the UK throwing its weight behind the books and booksellers in this digital age.
They're actually really useful and efficient, and they can be beautiful as well, and they can be life-changing, but also they can be things that can be passed on and shared. And I mean, there is something very special about the physical book.
We'll also get a privileged advanced look and hopefully an opportunity to play with the new iPhones with our tech correspondent, David Phelan.
Indeed. We'll also be checking the headlines out of the Asia-Pacific region and reviewing the Brazilian front pages too. We might even play some music too if you're good. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up with the headlines with David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Austrian police have found a body that they believe is the suspect in the fatal shooting of three policemen and a paramedic. The charred remains were discovered at a farmhouse owned by the suspect in Lower Austria. Special forces entered the building after a standoff lasting several hours. The drama began on Monday when officers tried to stop the man at a roadblock where they were trying to catch poachers. Tony Abbott has been sworn in as Australia's Prime Minister, officially ending 6 years of Labour government. His Conservative coalition won a comfortable lower house majority in the election 11 days ago. Mr Abbott has promised to scrap a tax on carbon emissions introduced by Labour and further toughen asylum policy. He already faces criticism, though, for naming just one woman in his 19-member cabinet. However, he promises to oversee a fair government.
We will be a problem-solving government based on values, not ideology. We will strive to govern for all Australians, including those who didn't vote for us. We won't forget those who are often marginalised, people with disabilities, Indigenous people, and women struggling to combine career and family. We will do our best not to leave anyone behind.
The five permanent members of the UN Security Council have met to discuss Syria. They're trying to agree a new resolution after the US and Russia put in place a plan to destroy the country's chemical stockpile. Edward Lucas, the international editor of The Economist, says Russia has been allowed to dictate the international response to the crisis in Syria, despite spending the last 2 years trying to stop other countries from intervening.
Russia has whitewashed its deplorable record over the last couple of years in the Syrian crisis, where it was consistently playing the role of spoiler, vetoing any attempt to put pressure on the Assad regime, and is now casting itself, bizarrely, as a peacemaker and getting a place at the top table. This not really because of Russia's strength, but because of the West's astonishing weakness and the appalling behaviour of President Barack Obama in particular.
More than 2,000 tourists have been airlifted by the army from Mexico's resort of Acapulco following deadly floods caused by Tropical Storm Manuel. Many more people remain stranded after some of the most damaging storms in decades. 55 people have been killed after the tropical storm was immediately followed by Hurricane Ingrid, the first time since 1958 that two powerful storms have hit Mexico within 24 hours. At least 16 prisoners have been killed in violence inside Venezuela's second largest jail. Officials said 15 of the inmates died in fights between rival gangs. The other victim was killed in a separate incident. Many of Venezuela's prisons are overcrowded, and Sabaneta, which is in the city of Maracaibo, houses nearly 4,000 people, five times more than its capacity. Emergency teams are searching for hundreds of people still missing after Colorado's deadly floods. State officials say more than 300 are unaccounted for, although most of those are thought to be merely cut off in remote areas. More than 3,000 people have been evacuated by air and ground after the storms. Six people have died in the floods and more than 1,000 homes destroyed. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
David, thank you very much. It's coming up to 6 minutes past 8 a.m. here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London,
desde Londres,
Holanda,
London, Europe,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. It's 14.06 in Jakarta, 10.06 in Beirut and 8.06 here at Midori House in London. And it's time now to set the day's news agenda. Here to do it is Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and former BBC Africa editor. What do you have for us this morning, Martin?
Well, I thought we'd just have a quick look at the shooting in America in Washington, which left 12 people dead with Aaron Alexis, now basically labelled as a nutter, to put it frankly. You know, they're saying that he had terrible, psychological problems, and that's why he went and did it. But what's really interesting about all this is why it is that it is impossible for the United States to basically crack the issue of reducing guns in society. And this all comes down to the National Rifle Association in the end. 5 million members, holding the whole the nation to ransom. Basically, they are such powerful lobbyists that it is impossible to break their hold over Congress and the basic lawmaking process.
And I mean, we've seen a couple of congressmen who've tried to push this through actually lose their seats.
Absolutely. And, you know, that is the threat that hangs over people. Because, and the extraordinary thing is, they are a tiny minority, but they are very well funded. They have a budget of something like $213 million. And there was absolutely tragic statement which was made by one of the lobbyists who themselves had experienced, you know, the deaths of their children. They came, these were ordinary men and women who came. They said, look, we're here today, but the National Rifle Association is here 8 days, 5 days a week, every single week of the year. And that is how they managed to operate.
I mean, it seems from an outsider's point of view that Sandy Hook was a moment in America, and the forces against the NRA seemed to coalesce, and it seemed for a moment at least that something was going to happen. Clearly, nothing did, and it seems that this is back to an old pattern of another shooting, more hand-wringing, but no action.
Absolutely. And the extraordinary thing is that the result of this relentless campaigning by the National Rifle Association is that where there was a 61% of Americans were in favour of gun control in 1990. Today, that lead is only down to 24. And in some of the years, it's actually been level pegging. People were, you know, who were for and against were actually on the same level. So people have this perception that unless you have guns in your hands, and they've sold this so well, the head of the National Rifle Association, Wayne Lapierre, has a sort of very simple phrase. He says, the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is to have a good guy with a gun. And he just keeps trotting that out, and it works.
But I mean, the FBI did set up background checks 15 years ago. People have to be checked. But I guess the problem is that a lot of those sales are private, or they're happening at gun fairs. It doesn't always go through the official channels.
Absolutely. And the end product is always the same. Of course, there is one countervailing tendency one has to bear in mind. Every Swiss person has to go for, I think it's only men, actually have to go for military service. And every Swiss family have guns in their homes. You don't find the Swiss going around shooting everybody. So what is it about the Americans that keep doing it? And I just don't know the answer to that question.
And the figure's actually astounding. It's 33 Americans, including 7 children, die every day from guns in America.
It's just tragic, absolutely.
I mean, is there at this point, after an incident like this, given how powerful the NRA are, as you say, an element of massaging the story? It is clearly in the NRA's interest, for example, for this shooter, as they would call him, to be labelled a crackpot rather than, it makes sense for him to be, sidelined, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, that's exactly the way that they do it. The other thing one should remember is that the American Constitution allows people, gives the people the right to carry guns. They always forget to quote the rest of that phrase, which is as part of a militia. So they forget that bit and they just want to have the right to carry guns. So if you were part of a militia, which was a controlled force, and yes, I can see the argument for that. But the idea now is just you've got to have your gun, got to even have it concealed. That's what they put their campaign for.
A lot of one-man militias in the US, aren't there?
Absolutely.
Really, really sad stuff. Well, let's move on actually to another militia in another part of the world, which is having an awful lot of strife at the moment. And we're going to Rwanda next.
Absolutely. You have Paul Kagame from the Rwandan Patriotic Front. He's been in power for 20 years, perhaps 19 years, actually. And he's just won another election, hands down, 76%. And in fact, if you actually look at the who was opposing him, the two parties were just clones of the ruling Rwandan Patriotic Front. So really, he won, in a sense, 100% of the vote. Not surprising. The main opposition leader, Victoire Ingabire, is in prison.
Sounds like not a great healthy state that the democracy in Rwanda is in, then.
I'm afraid not. And I'm sure if the African Union has sent some observers, they'll say it's free and fair. Because frankly, that's what they always say every time. Because one thing you can be sure about Rwanda, it's going to be very quiet, very tranquil, looks fine on the surface.
Of course, what it does mean is that things may ratchet up, really, for the Congo, because Kagame is supposedly a supporter of the M23 rebels, although he denies that. They say there's no official support, don't they?
Well, I don't think anybody takes his denials seriously anymore. There have been so many United Nations reports which indicate this is the case. And in the last week, he has moved his forces right up to the border. It's very serious. It is very tense in eastern Congo now, because there's a feeling that if there are any more shells land on Rwandan soil, he may send his troops in. There's going to be a big lobbying exercise on the margins of the General Assembly next Monday, which Mary Robinson is leading. She's one of the key people involved in trying to control the situation. And I think that's something we need to look out for.
It's the first time, though, that the UN's deployed blue helmets within a peace enforcement mission, isn't it? Rather than a peacekeeping, without a peacekeeping mandate. And of course, Rwanda's part of that, too. So essentially, they're fighting themselves.
Well, they're on the Security Council, are not a permanent member, a temporary member. Yes, that is true. And as you say, the blue helmets, the United Nations, have now a stronger mandate but they've, in a sense, they've had a Chapter 7 mandate, which allows them to use force for many years. What they are now is bolstered by is an international brigade from Africa, with the Tanzanians in charge and the South Africans there. So they are the side that are trying to control the situation in Congo against these various rebel groups, including the Rwandan-backed M23, have been reinforced. But will they be able to control the situation? I would be very surprised.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, if you look at it perhaps further on in a diplomatic war and looking at America, Obama could easily throw his lot behind Kabila because of his closeness to Tanzania and South Africa. On his recent Africa trip, of course, he visited those countries. He made a connection with the leaders, especially Kikwete. And so it's looking on a wider scale as if things could get really quite difficult.
They could indeed, although I think one has to be a little cautious about presidential promises on an African trip, because, you know, let's be honest about it, Africa is very low on President Obama's radar. I mean, what does he care about? He certainly cares much more about the American economy. And on the international stage, apart from Syria and worrying about the growth of the Chinese Navy, what do you think he really cares about? I don't think it's Africa.
Let's move on to Israel briefly now, Martin, if we can, and some constitutional wranglings going on in the High Court of Justice there.
Absolutely. The court basically, after a very long case, threw out a law which essentially said that it was possible for people that come across the border, particularly African migrants, mostly Eritreans and Sudanese, who come across the Negev Desert, can be held for up to three years in detention, which is appalling. And there's something like 60,000 Africans who have made that crossing, and thousands of them are now held in the Negev in pretty primitive conditions. Now, they aren't, forced back yet, but the other part of that policy is to actually, in the long run, send them back either to the country they came from or to Uganda, which has promised to accept some of them.
Why Uganda?
Good question, but the Ugandans have been, perhaps offered inducements. I would not be surprised if arms are supplied to President Museveni, and they've said that they are considering taking the refugees as they come across. But in a sense, it's a sort of declining story, because whereas a year ago, nearly 10,000 Africans came across the border, in the last 6 months, the same sort of period, comparable period, only 34 made it. So it's getting much, much tougher.
And clearly it's aroused concern from outside the country in various human rights groups. How much of a stink is this generating inside Israel?
Well, it's certainly on the front pages of the newspapers, but in the opposite direction, because quite a lot of the right-wing parties turn around and say, well, if we don't protect the Jewish nature of the Israeli state, it will stop being a Jewish state. And therefore, we must keep these people out. It's absolutely vital that we do so. And we're being flooded. And you can imagine the kind of rhetoric that gets ratcheted up. It's a sad story. And I think Africans there are having a pretty tough time.
Martin Plaut, always good to see you. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
On Midori House.
Coming up, we'll be in Berlin, days before the Germans cast their vote in the federal election.
Aperitivo is the latest addition to the Monocle 24 lineup. Airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time, Aperitivo is the perfect way to digest the day's biggest stories. From our studios at Midori House and over a flat white with special guests at the Monocle Cafe, we'll feature a relaxed blend of conversation and analysis that you simply won't hear anywhere else. That's Aperitivo, airing every weekday at 1800 hours London time. Brought to you in association with the Glenlivet.
Now, on Sunday, Angela Merkel was boosted by the Bavarian regional election result. The Conservative state is economically powerful and won an absolute majority in the regional parliament.
But it wasn't all wonderful. Her current Liberal partners in the national government didn't make it. The Free Democrats achieved just 3%. I asked Quentin Peel, Berlin bureau chief for the Financial Times, how serious that is.
It's a real problem because it means that the Free Democrats are going to now be scrambling to get as many Christian Democrats to vote for them as possible in the national elections so that they can get into Parliament. Well, every Christian Democrat vote that Ms. Merkel doesn't get will reduce her numbers, and it won't increase the absolute amount that the two get between them. So it means that it really doesn't help at all to win her back power with the coalition she wants. And it may end up leaving the whole German system in stalemate, with the far left holding the balance of power and only a grand coalition between Christian Democrats and Social Democrats will be the answer.
Can you just run us through the slightly complicated way Germany votes? Because as far as I can see, under the election system, they're able to cast two votes, one for the party and one for a candidate.
Yes. And the first one is for the candidate, and most of the big parties get their candidates through on the first vote. But the second vote is for the party, and that's the one that determines the final proportions in Parliament. And there's a new set of rules. The second vote now is the absolutely important one. So if you win more seats than you get the proportion in the second vote, you can't get the benefit from that. The small parties will get their numbers of seats topped up. So that's why Ms. Merkel is so keen to keep her second votes and not give them away to the Free Democrats. At the end of the day, she needs those second votes to have the largest party in the parliament.
So, I mean, results where the percentage of voters don't necessarily correlate directly with the number of seats a party wins, and that could be a problem. Might that mean that Bavarians, who make up Germany's second strongest voting bloc, could be less inclined to go to the polls 2 weeks in a row? I mean, they've done it, they've turned out once. Are they going to do it again?
Well, that is another question. And the Bavarians clearly regard Munich as the more important capital than Berlin. So some of them might say, well, we don't really care what happens in Berlin. And others might say, oh, well, look, we showed we were so strong in Bavaria. They don't need our votes. We'll get to power anyway. So another thing that Angela Merkel's got to do is mobilize her own supporters. And her whole style in this election campaign has been very downbeat. Not really a mobilization style, if anything, a demobilization style, just relying on her own popularity. So there is a problem. She's got to get her people to the vote.
Now, interesting that you mentioned Munich, because we're being told that the former journalist and the mayor of Munich for 20 years is solely responsible for increasing the share of the vote there.
Well, he was certainly as good a candidate as they could have hoped for. But the Social Democrats have a real problem in both the big states of the south, Bavaria and next door Baden-Württemberg, the two richest states in Germany. The Social Democrats are really trailing. They're down to under 20%, or only just about 20%. They should be on at least 30%. If they can't get their vote up in the south, they have a problem getting enough votes in the north. And that's the structural problem, if you like, that they face on the left. They're too weak down south. They're too weak in the areas where people are feeling comfortable, prosperous, have low unemployment, and they're not worried about the future.
What about this new party, Alternative for Germany?
Well, there the interesting thing is, will they take just enough votes away from Ms. Merkel's partners, the Liberal Free Democrats, or indeed from her own Christian Democrats, to deny them the majority that they want? That's the first question. The second is, might they actually get enough votes to get over the 5% hurdle which you need to get any seats in Parliament? If they do that and get, say, even as just 10 seats in the Bundestag, almost certainly that will mean that Ms. Merkel has to form a grand coalition with the Social Democrats.
Now, what they want is to scrap the euro.
They do indeed. And the interesting thing is that although there is quite a groundswell, a big minority, I would say, up to 20% of voters in Germany who actually are very unhappy with the euro and would like to have the Deutschmark back, the Alternative for Germany hasn't really managed to mobilize them. I think that people are worried that they're an unpredictable bunch. They are actually a very serious bunch of economics professors and law professors. They're rather nationalist. They want to go back to the old world, really. But they haven't broken through. And I think that the general feeling is they're not going to get out of single figures. They're going to be a very small factor in the equation.
Of course, there are lots of little parties and joke parties as well. Tell me about Die Party and their television commercial.
Well, the party is the ultimate sort of, excuse my language, piss taker. They really don't want anybody to really go and vote at all. They think the whole system is a farce, and they're trying to bring that home. But in the end of the day, it's the German election is a glorious time for all the weird and wacky ones to come out into the market stalls all round the country and advertise their wares, but they don't make any difference in the end.
Finally, the immigrant vote, particularly German Turks. Now, it seems that that's traditionally been for the Social Democrats, but more and more of them are now inclined towards the CDU. And that's despite their opposition to Turkish membership of the EU and their stance on dual nationality. Why do you think that change is taking place?
I think it's because the immigrant community is becoming more bourgeois. The second and third generations, there is a significant minority there who are moving into professional jobs and have become more prosperous. It's not a majority of the immigrant vote that the Christian Democrats are picking up, but it's up to about 30%. So it's a significant number, and it's actually another of the factors why the Social Democrats in Germany just haven't been tapping into enough protest votes and enough hostile votes to make an inroad into Chancellor Merkel's powerful position.
That was Quentin Peel, Berlin bureau chief for the Financial Times, talking to Georgina a little earlier. You are listening to Midori House. The time's 8:25 a.m. here in London. Now, it's a commonly held wisdom that books are covetable things, at once an example of human endeavour providing insights and escapism for us, the reader. But where e-readers and e-books play a crucial role in publishers' market strategy, with considerable savings for both the producer and the consumer, it's no surprise fans of the trusty book are worried it's becoming something of a collector's item.
But a new campaign hatched by big-name publishers and Maurice Sachi called Books Are My Bag attempts to halt the changing tide. To find out more, Monocle producer Alla John caught up with Patrick Neal, the president of the Booksellers Association. Patrick first explained how his association are leading the campaign from the front.
The Booksellers Association is an organisation that supports high street bookshops, and that covers the supermarkets who are members, it covers Waterstones, it covers Blackwell's, Foyles, and hundreds, if not thousands, of independent bookshops as well. And so they've been in partnership with the publishers and M&C Saatchi to get the Books Are My Bag campaign going. And it's all about reminding people how important the high street is. We all believe that bookshops are the best place to choose books and buy books.
So I take it that you don't buy into the tablet craze, the Kindles,
well,
the bookshops are the only place for you?
I have an e-reader myself. I think I've got two e-readers. I mean, we sell e-readers, and obviously, you know, we know all about Amazon, and we desperately try not to use Amazon for anything at all, but every now and again we have to own up, and, you know, it's the only place you can get something from. They are efficient. There's no point knocking them. They serve a purpose, and they're good. The e-reader, you know, if you are travelling, then it makes sense. But a physical book, it's not old-fashioned. I think there was a sort of PR story that basically books are just old-fashioned. They're actually really useful and efficient, and they can be beautiful as well, and they can be obviously life-changing, but also they can be things that can be passed on and shared. And I mean, there is something very special about the physical book still, and it's not going to go away. I mean, I've got an e-reader. I do use it, not as much as I ought to, but I just think books are a brilliant bit of technology themselves.
There's no denying the qualities of good books. Obviously, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who didn't agree with you on those points. There's also no denying that companies like Amazon, the Kindle itself, e-readers, they drive down costs for consumers. So the consumers do feel a benefit, but there is a kind of cost.
Absolutely. And I mean, in a way, that's the difficulty. And this is, thinking about value is really, really important in that, you know, it's my job to help people find the perfect gift. Now, that I might not be able to give them that thing
for a certain price,
at half price or whatever, but every day I'm asked, you know, to recommend the perfect book, but I'm also asked to suggest poems for readings at funerals, people who are struggling to read, children who are struggling to read. And so even though you might have to pay a little bit more, it might be the thing that just hits the spot that helps that person and really does change their life. So the problem about value is, you know, at the immediate point, it might seem cheaper, but it might actually be a really rubbish gift. Or, you know, it might work, it might be fine, and that's great.
It's hard to cherish a Kindle or an electric e-book.
This is it. I've just been on holiday in America, and I spent a lot of money on books in America, and there's nothing more stupid than me buying books. But, I was in beautiful bookshops, and I saw something, and I just thought, well, I could go home and order it at home, but no, I want it now. And that's exactly the point, that that will be special to me because I'll remember that I bought it, you know, while on holiday with my kids. And so, I think that this problem about value is really difficult because
there's just so much more to life than that immediate saving.
There is, of course, and people do cherish books. We've talked about some of the challenges that a campaign such as Books Are My Bag would face. What are you hoping that the campaign will bring to the broader public? What are the challenges, but also what are the aims of the campaign?
Well, the important thing to me is the partnership between publishers and booksellers with M&C Saatchi's help. But that shows that publishers aren't turning their backs on bookshops, because I think a couple of years ago, ebooks were the new shiny toy, and so it seemed like publishers thought that we were probably dead in the water. And so that was really reassuring that publishers do still, I think, are actually starting to show more interest in bookshops again than maybe they had a few years ago. So that's a good start.
What's driving that?
Well, publishers have to deal with Amazon. They probably, in their heart of hearts, wish that they didn't have to. But we understand the business model, and we, you know, if you want your author to get to number one, you're going to have to sell through Amazon. But it's a healthier market where there's just more than one channel, and I think to a certain extent, Amazon probably understand this, that we are feeding a love of books, and we're nourishing the whole ecosystem. And if we disappear, that probably would damage Amazon as well. So I think a healthy environment is where there's multi-channel.
There is a danger that books become this product that people love to cherish.
Yeah.
And they become a thing which people will spend more money on, but to a much lesser degree
than the
sort of daily consumed novel or, you know, a poetry book or whatever it is, or a textbook. And Amazon is obviously seizing on opportunities like that because they will provide the much broader, more commonly consumed books at a lower cost. And that benefits publishers who want to print less because it costs them.
No, absolutely. And there is this sort of people coming in, and we're almost like a museum, that we're a wonderful thing that in the good old days used to work and doesn't. But I certainly think for my generation, there's enough. I think as long as publishers still produce beautiful books, I still think that we'll be okay. I mean, my concern is that we go to the sort of vinyl equivalent of the music industry, which is a very, very niche, rather than being a general thing. My little bookshop in our little town, you know, our shop windows are promoting books all the time. And so if these shops disappear, it will unsettle the whole industry. So it's worth fighting for.
Patrick Neal talking to Monocle's Alad John there.
Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we'll check the news in the Asia-Pacific region. We'll review the Brazilian front pages, and we will be getting a sneak peek of the new iPhone with our tech correspondent, David Phelan. I can confirm the iPhones. They're in the building. They're here.
He is so excited.
Yes.
First, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Georgina, thank you very much indeed. Police have found the charred body of a man that they believe is the suspect in a shooting in Austria in which three policemen and a paramedic were killed. The 55-year-old had barricaded himself in his farmhouse, and special forces were called in to storm the building. Russia says that a UN Security Council resolution on Syria's chemical weapons would not contain any references to the use of force. Moscow says the priority is to implement the destruction of Syria's chemical weapons, not to discuss Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which allows the use of force. Brazil's president has scrapped a planned visit to the United States over claims she's been spied on by US intelligence agencies. Leaked documents claim Dilma Rousseff's emails had been intercepted, as well as messages from her aides. A two-day nationwide strike has been called across Bangladesh in response to an Islamist leader being sentenced to death for war crimes. Abdulkader Mullah's party says his trial was politically motivated. Tony Abbott has been sworn in as Australia's new Prime Minister after his victory in the election 11 days ago. His Conservative coalition plans to scrap a tax on carbon emissions and further toughen asylum policy. And a woman survived 15 days trapped down a well in central China by eating raw corn and drinking rainwater. The 38-year-old fell into the 4-metre-deep well in Henan province on the 1st of September, was eventually rescued on Monday afternoon. Those latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Mr. Spencer. Now, in the last few days, you may have noticed that those friends of yours who are particularly fervent fans of Apple and its products have started to salivate. Yes, it's that time of year again where the tech giant brings out its latest iPhone model. Only this time your friends might well be salivating twice as much as normal because for the first time there are two new iPhones rocketing towards the market.
A lot of that salivating going on right here in the studio.
Don't know what you mean.
I have to tell you. The iPhone 5S is the more predictable of the two. The next generation device follows in the pattern Apple established in 2007. The revelation is the iPhone 5C. It marks Apple's first foray into so-called cheaper options, as well as its first experiment with Technicolor. Well, I am delighted to tell you that we can get our hands on them right now. David Phelan, our technology supremo, has bought both models with him this morning. Dominic Reynolds can hardly contain himself. It's just hours after the Apple embargo has been lifted. David, you have been ungagged.
Thank you. I can't tell you how much better I feel now.
Okay, so I've got the 5C in my hand at the moment. Should we start with this one?
Yeah, cool. To
the untrained eye, which mine definitely is, the design is obviously different. It's a softer, smoother sort of back, and it's multicoloured as well.
Yes, that's right. 5C, which stands for colour, not cheap as some people thought, or China, thinking this was Apple's way into the Chinese market, although it may be. It's the first phone that has a plastic, or polycarbonate, as they like to say, casing rather than metal and glass. And it comes in five colours, green, pink, blue, yellow and white. And what's interesting about it is that plastic phones sound cheap, and this is anything but. It's as you say, it's very smooth. It's so glossy, you can barely look at it, and it feels fantastic in the hand. And I think it will appeal to an audience who have sometimes maybe felt that Apple was too serious or too high-end. This is the iPhone for them.
That's interesting. I mean, that idea of it being a response to something, I guess, is key to this. I mean, we should presumably be viewing this as their response to the battle against Samsung and the various other rivals.
Yeah, definitely. Until now, the process has been that last year's model becomes this year's budget model. Last year's model, the iPhone 5, is going to be withdrawn from sale, and this will be the new, not budget, but lower priced model. So it's recognizing that Apple needs to do more than just produce one phone a year. It needs to have more strings to its bow.
Just a couple of business questions, because unusually for Apple, they've refused to announce sales figures for the new iPhone 5. There's that, coupled with the fact that there are reports that the Chinese mega mobile network, China Telecom, has reduced its subsidy. Will either of those things severely affect the share price?
It has affected the share price. I think it knocked $15 off it yesterday because they didn't announce initial sales or pre-orders of the iPhone 5C. I wonder, when the phones go on sale, which is on Friday, if there will be a slightly different strategy revealed. You can't pre-order the premium iPhone 5S, only the 5C. And so there will be a lot of people who are holding back until they've compared the two to see which one is the one for them. But I suspect it's going to do very well. But yes, Apple are taking a risk by not announcing things up front. And as for China, yes, subsidies are always going to be a big, big issue in every territory. But Apple doesn't quite have the muscle it has in the UK and the US to ensure that it gets the price it wants. So we'll have to see.
Aren't Apple risking sort of diluting their USP? That they've always been about cleanliness and simplicity, and their product lines have operated on that same principle. There's been one of everything. There's been one phone. There's been one iPad. I mean, are they risking just becoming like every other tech company by releasing multiple models at the same time?
I think that is a risk. There are several iPads. There's the iPad Mini, but you're right, they're both the high-end metal version. And they've sometimes had a budget iPod, for example, the iPod Shuffle. But this is the first time that there has been a completely different design language and a lower price without it being an evidently budget machine. I think it's partly because of the new operating system, the software which arrives for anyone who's got an iPhone 4 or more recent and is downloadable today and is free and has lots of new features. So a lot of people will think, well, I don't need to upgrade because I've effectively got a new phone. And that is much more gaudy and primary coloured. and it's designed entirely to fit with the colours chosen for the iPhone 5C.
David, you've got another shiny gadget there.
Yes. So I have two others, in fact. This one's the iPhone 5S, which I have to unlock because it's very coolly got a fingerprint sensor in it.
I was trying to break into your phone and was finding it rather difficult.
So in order to make it work, you have to have one of my thumbs. Fingerprint sensor, I have to say, sounds like a ridiculous gimmick, and I'm completely sold on it. So many email systems, including the Monocle one, actually, when you put it on your phone, you have to put a passcode into your phone before it will let the email work. I don't need that anymore. I can just put my thumb on it, and it opens up, and only for me.
I mean, I did hear the rather more alarmist ends of the technology market suggesting that this might lead to a spate of people being de-thumbed as they're mugged.
That's right. And at that point, we must be grateful that it's not a retinal scan that opens the phone.
Now, you're actually stroking something over there, too.
Yes.
And it's a lovely colour, I must say. What is that?
This is another brand new handset that's arriving this week, and it's the Nokia Lumia 1020. And it's a big, chunky phone, also plastic. No one does plastic like Nokia and now Apple.
Can I have a feel?
Yes, do.
Thanks.
And it's a beautiful phone. It uses Windows Phone 8 as its operating system. And the big news is round the back. The camera is very prominent because it's a 41 megapixel sensor so that you can take extraordinary photographs with it. The problem with camera phones is you can't there's no room for an optical zoom in most of them. If you've got 41 megapixels, you can use a digital zoom, go into cropping the center of the picture and still have enough pixels to make a great picture.
David, thank you so much. We're going to shuffle up together so that Dom can take a picture of us on this shiny new gadget and we'll be moving on shortly.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se ti cece.
From London,
London. London, caralho.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. It is 8:41 in London. Time now to take a look at what's making the news in the Asia Pacific region. Gwen Robinson joins us on the line now. Gwen, welcome to the programme. Where would you like to start today?
Well, I'm sitting right now in Sydney, so it seems as good a place as any to start, particularly as the new Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, was sworn in today. With his nearly all-male cabinet, which has created some waves.
And, of course, he is the person that has been accused famously by Julia Gillard of being a misogynist. Is that reflected, do you think, in his cabinet makeup, or is that just unfortunate?
Well, it's either an unfortunate coincidence or it's deliberate, but he's lowered the female representation in his cabinet to 1 out of 19 cabinet members, and under the former Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, who admittedly was a woman, there were 6. So the big joke now is that Australia has fewer women represented in government than Afghanistan, which has 3. So I would say it could hardly be just chance. But Abbott has insisted that these are the best people for the job. The one woman is a high-profile position, which is Foreign Minister Julie Bishop. But there are many other things that have created controversies, even as Abbott just takes up the reins, and two are his position on refugees and boat people. He's really taken a strong turn to the right, going further even than Julia Gillard, who was forced into some pretty draconian measures by public sentiment. And the other one is green technology and environment. He's repealing the unpopular carbon tax, or at least it was unpopular with big companies, and also, I think, general public, but that also is a concern, I think, for environmentalists, because he's also dismantling some of the environmental agencies of the government. So these are not great signs to start off with if you care about gender equality, environment, boat people, things like that. But it's clearly what the electorate wanted. He won by a very comfortable margin.
And he won after an election campaign that got pretty nasty in places. Is it a question of sort of licking his election war wounds at this point?
Oh, I don't think so at all. He's going around with a very self-satisfied smirk on his face. But I think the nastiness was really what the former Labour government did to itself. I mean, people say I grew up for a while in Australia, and politics were pretty nasty and rough and tumble under the Labour Prime Ministers Paul Keating and Bob Hawke. But this is, I think this has taken it into a new realm with leaders deposing each other twice around with Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd. And then the fight with the Conservatives, the Liberals, did get quite nasty, and insults were traded, as you said. Gillard calling Abbott a misogynist, and Abbott calling Gillard barren because she didn't have any children and couldn't understand childcare policies and things like that. So that's pretty nasty. I should say, adding to the spectacle, next week Julia Gillard is breaking her silence and doing a big show at the Opera House, Sydney Opera House, being interviewed by one of the leading feminist icons in Australia. They're selling tickets to that, which is turning the whole thing, I think, into a spectacle. It sold out within an hour.
It sounds absolutely extraordinary. We'd like to move on, if we can, to you say Myanmar, we say Burma, or perhaps the other way around. What's the correct name these days?
Well, you know, I mean, the Burmese, and we'll call them Myanmarese, insist that Myanmar is the name. And in fact, you know, I'm glad you brought it up, because it still is getting debated in some circles. But actually, technically, I mean, it is Myanmar as recognised by the United Nations and an increasing number of countries. I think Britain is uncomfortably sort of moving between using Myanmar and Burma. But I think I think Monocle 24 could be PC and use Myanmar, really.
Whatever the name of the country, it does seem that they're getting a lot of international contracts and things are improving economically there.
Indeed. I mean, I think obviously there are still wobbles. There's ethnic insurgency. There's, you know, peace negotiations underway in various parts of the country, and there is still some nastiness. Nearly all political prisoners have been released, but there are some issues. However, the real focus is really moving now. You can see that very strongly, particularly in the last couple of months, to the economy, investment. Today, the government has just announced winners for 18 onshore oil and gas blocks that foreign companies have all bid for. Last month, I mean, we've had telecommunications licenses let to foreign companies and Norwegian Telenor and another company. We've had big companies such as Nissan just announcing a few days ago that they'll assemble cars in Myanmar, which is a real first. I was at a huge investment conference last week in the unfortunately named capital, Naypyidaw, which was completely packed. 850 investors attending. Concurrently, there was a telecommunications convention that attracted sellout numbers. So it does seem like people are very interested. But one small cloud on the horizon is that speaking to some of the funds that are trying to raise money for investments, many of these people are complaining that it's very hard to actually get people to sign the dotted line on checks and contracts. So that's still hard coming. But, you know, you've got the big names flooding in, Coca-Cola, GE, and the government. Every week there's some sort of new policy designed to appeal to investors.
Gwen, let's talk briefly, if we can, about economics elsewhere in the region, in Thailand. Plenty of commentators of the opinion that the economy is heading in the wrong direction. You think different?
Yes, I do, but that's because over many years of observing Thailand, no matter what awful things happen, for example, 2 years ago it was half underwater with the flood crisis, and the economy looked like it was tanking, and then there was people shooting each other in the streets the year before that. The Thais always seem to bounce back. But you're right, what happened recently was a big slide in the stock market, a big weakening of the baht. That was partly due to a general malaise that's beset Southeast Asian markets in particular, partly related to, you know, the Federal Reserve in the US policies. But I think at the moment, Thailand has had a big wobble, and it's had its own problems. You might have heard about these very angry protests by rubber farmers in the south. And rubber is a very important export for Thailand, and the prices have been going down. They're very angry that they're not getting help from the government, and the protests have turned violent. You might have heard about the controversial rice subsidy scheme, with angry rice farmers in the northeast also having nearly violent protests or very vocal protests. And to add to their woes, a strange disease has hit shrimp farms. And Thailand is actually the world's leading shrimp exporter, and that's absolutely slashed their exports. So they've got woes on several fronts with their commodities exports, but at the same time they've got a huge amount of foreign investment there, Japanese particularly, in factories, and exports do appear to be picking up slightly, although the figures so far this year have not been great.
Gwen Robinson in Sydney, many thanks for your time.
Now you're listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds and Georgina Godwin. In a moment we'll take a look at the Brazilian press. Before we do, let's listen to an iconic singer from Sao Paulo, Rita Lee, with the summery vibes of Chega Mais.
With Chega Mais.
And you are listening to Midori House. I was just letting it sort of fade out there underneath us.
And also feeling a bit nervous about the pronunciation because Fernando's here. And of course, he speaks Brazilian Portuguese, and we're kind of struggling along again.
He does.
We want to say Rita, but we're supposed to say Rita, isn't that
But
right?
You both had an amazing accent, I have to say.
Thank you very much. Can't be scared of Fernando's judgment, surely.
And I'm so glad to hear Rita Lee first thing in the morning. That's a beautiful thing to do.
Yeah. Okay, was that a suggestion of yours, Fernando?
Of course. I always select my songs when I do the newspaper review.
Your opening number.
Exactly.
Fernando's opening number. Well, as you've gathered, Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here to take a look through this morning's Brazilian front pages.
And as you could imagine, the main story today is on the cover of Folha de São Paulo and the Globo newspaper as well, is the fact that Dilma confirmed yesterday that she was postponing her state visit to the U.S. because of the allegations that the U.S. has been spying in our country, including our main one of our biggest companies like Petrobras. And it's interesting to see because it's been almost 20 years that Brazil had the last state visit to the U.S. That was back in 1995 with Fernando Henrique Cardoso. So I think it was quite a brave decision about her. I was not so sure that she was going to cancel this trip. And of course, the opposition leader said, oh, this is just a marketing decision for her. Which might be. I think it's going to help her popularity.
But also, she was in a pretty privileged position to be getting a state visit. She was one of a very exclusive club to be having the sort of full treatment in the US this year. So it's a pretty big deal to step back. What sort of reaction are we seeing in Brazil to her decision?
Well, to be honest with you, I think the average Brazilian, most of them are happy that she's not going, you know, because they feel hurt, you know, like how can the US spy us without we didn't know about that. People were kind of surprised, even though these things have been happening all the time. So I'm sure that they did it for every government previous to her. But I think this is going to really help her for the presidential elections next year. And as you can see on the front page of Folha de São Paulo, she's wearing a bright pink T-shirt.
See, I'm interested in your theories here because you have a sort of political and fashion sort of super theory about Dilma.
This is something that I've just been noticing after the protests in June where her popularity really fell down and it was huge crisis in the Brazilian government. She's been wearing more color, you know. I've seen pink, purple, yellow, and I think this is kind of helping, you know. You wouldn't like to vote for a drab politician wearing just brown, and I include men on that.
Don't say
as
that
well.
To the Germans.
and I'm not being sexist because I'm including men on that one as well.
Absolutely. So. I love the way that her sartorial choices will influence your political decision. I think it's great. Can we move on? There's another article in the same paper, actually. It's a very interesting poll.
Exactly. You know, they're saying the majority of Brazilians are against a reopening of the Men's Salon case. And I'm just going to quickly explain the Men's Salon case. It was one of our biggest corruption scandals in the country. It happened during Lula's government from 2002 to 2010. And basically, the men's salon was when MPs were bribed to vote according to the measures the government wanted to pass in Congress. And 25 people were accused already, but 12 out of those 25, they want to reopen the case. They want to be judged again because they said they don't agree with the judgment. And of course, I mean, people were happy that they were going to prison, whatever, but now probably they're not going anymore. And 79% wanted an immediate prison for those MPs. So, I mean, and I kind of agree with them. They said, because it was such a big moment in Brazilian politics when they were finally accused and some of them went to prison, that people don't want to say, hey, oh, so this is not happening anymore. So, yeah, I think that's not surprising, but that's on the front page as well.
Okay, let's hop over to the front page of O Globo.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say, but more politics today.
Okay,
same pink shirt actually she's wearing.
Exactly. Well, at least there's always a pink shirt to make us a little bit lighter. But today was officially announced that the PSB, the Brazilian Socialist Party, which has been growing the last few elections, is one of the fast growing parties in Brazil. They're officially leaving the government today. And the fact is, they more or less have the same center-left views, but their leader, Eduardo Campos, he might be one of the candidates for next year, and he's very charismatic. At the moment, he's currently third on the latest polls for the presidential elections. I don't think he's going to win next year, but I think he's going to be a good bet for 2018 or 2022. So watch out for Eduardo Campos, a very successful governor of the state of Pernambuco in the northeast of Brazil.
And what does it mean for the government that he's leaving, that it won't have his participation anymore?
Well, I think it's definitely going to affect. But of course, Dilma managed to have a very big coalition, so she still have the majority in Congress. So it's not going to be a huge setback. But of course, I'm sure Dilma is worried about Eduardo Campos. And I have to say, they're friends as well. As I said, they have more or less the same views. So of course, people who would usually vote for Dilma might vote for him. So it's not that he's a completely right-wing guy, you know, that going to have another type of vote.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much indeed, as ever.
And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks very much to our producers. They were Barbara Feeney and they were Alid John. Our researchers were that guy Fernando Augusto Pacheco. He's everywhere, isn't he? Matt Alagaya too. And managing the studio today was Alex Funnell.
Up next after the news, it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie.
And Cordelia Lynch will be joining me tomorrow for Midori House at exactly the same time. But for now, from me, Dominic Reynolds.
And me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.